This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Lorenzo Carcaterra grew up in New York City's Hell's Kitchen, a poor neighborhood of European immigrants. It was a rough place with a lot of violence in the homes, including Carcaterra's. But in the 1960s, the streets of Hell's Kitchen were safe enough for Carcaterra and his three best friends to run free and make mischief. It was such a safe, enclosed world that despite the violence at home, Carcaterra remembers his childhood as idyllic. But all that changed when in the summer of 1967, one of the boys' harmless pranks went awry, leaving an old man injured near death. Carcaterra and his three friends were sentenced to a year in reform school. Lorenzo Carcaterra has written a book about what happened that year. It's called Sleepers. The names, dates, and places in the story have all been changed to protect those involved. Carcaterra said that though Hell's Kitchen was a training ground for many young criminals, he and his three friends were innocents by comparison, and their pranks playful.
There was this gimmick I could do. I could take a shelf of library books and sort of hook them into, hook the center of the, say, 25 books. You can put it in such a way that if you pull the center book out, all 25 would fall. That, I guess, we thought was cute at the time. We released a bag of mice once out of in church, and that really upset the nuns, which, you know, caused great laughter. People, for whatever reason, used to get a kick out of seeing nuns upset. We did that with the clacker. The nuns, I don't know, for those of you not familiar with Catholic school education, nuns use clackers as a way of standing, sitting, depending on how many times they clacked it for the girls that they were in care of. So we got our hands on a clacker, and so we were in church, and the nun would clack it once, and the girls would sit. We'd clack it twice, they'd stand. The nuns would clack it again, they'd sit, and we'd clack it three times, they'd kneel. It was total chaos. So it was that kind of innocent, fun. We would sneak in and try to listen to confessions on Saturday afternoon, which is not, believe me, advocated, but it was a lot of fun.
Well, tell us what happened then. In the summer of 1967, you were setting up a kind of a scam of a hot dog vendor. What happened?
Yeah, it was really, I mean, in hindsight, it was probably the dumbest, stupidest thing we could have done. We had this thing going where if you have a hot dog stand, which, you know, are pretty common in New York City, three of us would hide. One would go up to the hot dog vendor and ask for a hot dog and get it, whatever you want, mustard, onions, the whole bit. And then you run. Now, the vendor is then left with two choices. One, he can chase you, at which point, if he does chase you, the three come in and help themselves and, you know, eat as many hot dogs as they want. Two, he doesn't chase you, in which case you get a free hot dog. In this particular case, the vendor chased me, and my friends helped themselves. And then they got this idea in the back of their head that maybe they could push the cart up a couple of blocks. We're on 10th Avenue. And I don't know for what reason. I have no idea to this day what their intent was. I guess just to move it a few blocks, a few avenues. And I caught up to them a couple of blocks up, and there was nothing else to do. And I think what they decided at the last minute, the ultimate goal of this prank was to hold it above a subway station platform, and have this guy dive for it and catch it at the last minute. Well, you know, in hindsight, obviously that doesn't happen, and the thing fell, and unfortunately an elderly man was coming up, and he was physically harmed, and we were in severe trouble.
Well, the man ended up in a hospital.
He ended up severely injured, almost died, from what I understand, and had to live with the remnants of his wounds for the rest of his life.
Well, you and your friends were sentenced to a year at a reformatory in upstate New York. It was called Wilkinson's. What was the reputation of this school?
Well, I changed the names and places and dates in the book to hide the identities of the people involved. We call the place in the book Wilkinson's. It was among the neighborhood, the reputation was that it was a strict place. A lot of people I knew from the area had been up there. But the thing about a neighborhood and the kind of people who grew up in that neighborhood is that you don't talk about these things openly. You don't discuss. You don't say, hey, I just spent a year at Wilkinson and this happened and this happened and that happened. You do your time, and it's almost like having been to Vietnam. A lot of the Vietnam veterans that I knew as I got older very seldom spoke about their experiences in Vietnam. So even though I knew there were a number of people in the neighborhood who had been to homes like Wilkinson, no one really said anything about it. So my father was sort of torn. He had this, on the one hand, having been in prison, he knew the negatives and the dangers of it. On the other hand, he had very limited knowledge of juvenile prisons and didn't want to probably scare me too much in the event that nothing would occur. So he really didn't know how to react. So we really went in here all four of us, with blinders on. We really didn't know what to expect. We expected, obviously didn't expect to get what we did get, but we went in pretty closed-eyed and thinking, all right, it's going to be a year. We're going to be upstate. How bad could it be?
Well, you write about the savage beatings, the sexual assaults that began really almost immediately once you got to Wilkinson's. And this was all done by guards who worked there. Describe for us, I guess, the kind of control that these guards had over the boys there and over that institution itself.
Well, I don't know about the whole place because, you know, you're in the limited area of a large place. I do know about these four guards in particular who victimized us simply because I think one of the reasons were that what worked for us on the streets of Hell's Kitchen, that we were not these tough kids, we were sort of pranksters, innocent pranksters, worked against us in an institution where innocent pranksters are seen as gullible victims, that you can take advantage of these kids because you're not going to get retribution. We weren't part of a gang. We weren't part of a organized crew from the outside that people could look at. We weren't tough. So I think these four guards in particular who were inclined to take advantage of kids like that, each and every day, whether it was physical, psychological, however, whatever the method was, there was never a moment ever in that 1 year period where you could relax, where the sound of a turning doorknob didn't make you break out into a cold sweat, where you could sleep in a restful sleep, where you could, I mean, that was worse, quite honestly, that is worse than any rape and any sodomy and any of the other things that they, messing with your food and all that stuff. The inability to relax, the inability at an early age to just take a deep breath and say, okay, I'm going to just go to bed now. The inability to be able to think childhood thoughts, the constant fear, the constant tension, the constant nervousness, the constant anxiety is something that you never forget, that you never shake, and that will stay with you till the day you die.
And you feel that some today?
I feel it completely today. I mean, I was telling someone earlier, you know, everyone, I read interviews with authors all the time who write about difficult subjects, who say, oh, it's so therapeutic to write about it and this and that. I found this to be worse than I could ever imagine. I mean, going through the second part of the book, which dealt with the abuse in the juvenile institution, is something that it reawakened it. It was always there. It's always something I deal with. It's something, you know, and it's not anything can quite honestly set it off. A strip of clothing, the way somebody looks at you, the way they comb their hair, how they move, how they don't move, really sets it off. This writing about it has amplified that to a degree, more than talking about it. Writing about it has amplified it to a degree that it's constantly present, and it's present in quick, short flashes. I mean, you'll see a leg in a baton, you'll see a guard's sweaty shirt, you'll see a crying, or you'll hear a boy cry, and then it goes away. It is always, always present.
Could you, I know you didn't, but could you, in hindsight, ever have reported what was going on a daily basis to someone in authority there?
I guess you could have. You know, I've thought about that. I think you could have. But again, keep in mind, we're coming from an environment, the four of us, where, you know, the quote is, you don't rat anybody out. You don't go to squeal to somebody. A friend of mine visited me. He was about 8 or 9 years older than I was. He was dating a girl in a neighborhood, and he came to visit me a couple of times while I was up there. And he saw me bruised the two times he came to see me. And, you know, no one in those days thought of child abuse, thought of sexual abuse. He asked me what happened, and I said, well, you know, I got out of line, and one of the guards roughed me up. And in our environment, our world, that made perfect sense.
Well, what the guards seemed to do, and there was one in particular you call Sean Noakes, who seemed to be the kind of ringleader, was that they would play off of each of you, off of your fears. They would abuse one of your friends in front of you.
Right.
They would threaten something in front of you. And I guess with your own imagination and knowing, of course, what you were going through, imagining then what your friend was going through.
Yeah, they played their games. I mean, you know, they were very good at what they did. And, you know, the thing, there are a number of things I remember about the character called Sean Noakes. None of them are pleasant. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, he liked to play the mental games much more than the physical. I think he was in many ways less a participant in the physical than he was an instigator of the mental. But it gave him control. I mean, these guys were pretty much from similar backgrounds, from what I understand. They were, you know, high school educated. They were from small towns. You know, they all wanted to be cops, but they couldn't pass the test, so they took this job. And it gave him a sort of muscular control. You used to see it in some neighborhoods. You'll always see the guy who, you know, gets picked on in the neighborhood moves to another neighborhood and starts picking on other kids, all younger kids. I mean, we knew the only thing that was running through my mind, the only positive, was that Noakes or any of those other three guys would have survived 1 second in Hell's Kitchen with the crews that were there. I mean,
that was enough to kind of keep you alive, that
it
thought.
It kept me going, and that, you know, this guy, we're here now. We're unprotected, and he can take full advantage. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a part in the book after we're worked over that Michael tells him, one of my friends tells Noakes, you know, kill me now because you can't run the risk of one day knowing or meeting up with us in a place that's not Wilkinson. And I think Michael really believed that. I didn't, quite honestly. I just wanted to get out of there and forget about it. But Michael really believed that somewhere, somehow, down the road, someplace, whether it's going to take 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, he would run into one of these guys or all of these guys again. And again, once we got out of there, the four of us, none of us ever spoke about it. We never discussed it with each other. I never talked about it to anybody. I never talked about it to my father, to my family members. Again, it's not something you discuss. It's not something, if someone did ask, you know, or I never knew who knew in my family or who didn't know. For example, my father kept his word to me, apparently, and told no one that he was related to, that I was up there. We didn't see many family members. People from the neighborhood that knew me knew that I was away, but that was about it. So it was not. Once we got out of there, we buried it as deep as we could in our minds. A couple of us moved away. I was sent to Italy for a while, and that helped quite a bit. I went to a great Catholic high school, and that helped enormously. And for a couple of years, I was able to bury it. And I think it's almost like the initial shock is still in there, so you don't deal with it. And you're too young to know how to deal with it.
Were you really able to bury what you had been through? And I'm wondering about things like nightmares or the kinds of emotions that tend to sort of bubble up when you're more unconscious.
No. I have nightmares, quite honestly, to this day. I was under therapy for a number of years, and while that was helpful, again, I find things that bring it to the surface, for me personally, much more difficult to deal with. I think the two characters of John and Tommy, in some way are the lucky ones. They came out of that place. All of us came out with our childhood stripped. Mm-hmm. John and Tommy came out and said, well, okay, they came out with this hard shield, this hard edge to them. Nobody, no one at any point, at any time in their lives was ever going to touch them again. That's the biggest crime to me in this book, is that they took the two sweetest, nicest kids, John and Tommy, who would have done anything. I mean, they're the kinds of kids, if you had just looked at John's eyes, you'd get him an ice cream cone. He had this black Irish charm. He could do anything. Women as an adult would just melt at his look. Yet they took these two sweet-natured kids and turned them into hardened criminals.
They became professional hitmen.
They became criminals. They made their money through crime. Michael and I, again, at a somewhat early age, we had the luxury of parents who took us out of there, out of the neighborhood, and put us in, you know, places with trees and birds and things. But we just decided, A, we weren't as tough as even maybe we thought a little bit that we were, and we just certainly didn't want to go back to that place. And maybe the legal way of living is a boring way, is dull, is unexciting, but, you know, it sure beats going up to a place like Wilkinson. So we each went our separate routes. We stayed friends. We kept contact as we grew older and older. And we kept this little secret among us. We never, ever, under any circumstances, discussed it. Even if there was a hint that we were heading that way to bring it up, somebody would quickly change the topic and the subject.
Well, I want to take a short break and we'll talk some more. I continue this story. And our guest today is Lorenzo Carcaterra. His book is called Sleepers, and it's a story of his own childhood growing up in Hell's Kitchen. He and three of his friends were incarcerated for a prank that got out of control. They ended up in a tough reform school where they were savagely beaten, sexually assaulted, and then years later were able to get some revenge on what happened to them. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Lorenzo Carcaterra. His new book is called Sleepers. Well, to continue this story, it's 1979. You now are young adults, and everyone is out of this reform school. John Riley, Tommy Marcano are, as you said, ruthless or professional killers. They are part of the underworld. They find themselves in a restaurant with Sean Noakes, the man from the reform school that had been the ringleader of the abuse that happened to them there. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, life works in, as they say, mysterious ways. And for us, it just events led to two guys being in a room with one guy who shouldn't have been in the room. And the short end of the stick is John and Tommy recognized Sean Noakes much sooner than he recognized them, and did the only thing that they had trained themselves to do. They killed him. They shot and murdered him.
Is there any thought that you have that they had plotted this in any way, or was it truly just a chance occurrence?
I think if they plotted it, I'm not aware of it. I doubt very much. You know, I just think it's just someone walks in. I mean, it happens every day. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. But the nutshell is they walked in on Sean Noakes. They shot and killed Sean Noakes in cold blood. Their arrogance was such that they just walked out, shot the man, and left.
And there were people there. There were witnesses that saw exactly what happened.
Yeah, there were some eyewitness. But again, their reputation was so fierce that I really think they believed. I think they believed two things. I think, one, they believed that no one would come forward. And quite honestly, if someone did come forward, they didn't care. I mean, that's how cold they were. They just didn't care. You're going to put me away? Fine. He's dead. I'm glad. That's their attitude.
Well, and then to complicate the story even more, Michael, the fourth person in this friendship was a district attorney in New York City, and he involved himself in the case. He decided to take it on to prosecute the case.
Right. Michael came to me. We had dinner shortly after John and Tommy were apprehended for this murder. And I had visited both of them. So I was talking to Michael. We would periodically have dinner. I was working as a clerk at the newspaper, at the New York Daily newspaper at the time. So we met at this downtown restaurant, and he said, we had dinner. And he was sort of, I mean, Michael is not very talkative to begin with, but he was less so that night. And it was a rainy night, and he said, we barely got through the meal, and I wanted a cup of coffee. And he said, take it to go. We got to talk. And we talked. We walked down the piers, surrounded by hookers and, you know, all that area downtown Manhattan. It's sort of our red light district. And in this rain, he lays out this plan for us that he had in the back of his mind. He showed me folders, and he had folders on the three other guards. He had folders on Noakes. He had folders on anything that pertained to the case. And he said, basically, I'm going to go in and ask for this case. And you can take a case under mitigating circumstances, even though he was an inexperienced attorney, a young attorney, wasn't totally inexperienced. But the mitigating circumstances, as far as he could see, going into his supervisor, were simply this. He knew the neighborhood. He knew the mentality of the area. He knew the way that people thought and acted, and that he could cull this case together. And in legal parlance, I've been told such a case is called a no-lose. You got two shooters, you got with a vicious reputation, you have eyewitnesses. I mean, even, you know, you and I could try this case.
But didn't the court have any kinds of records that the four of you had been incarcerated together, or that they and you had been incarcerated at the place where Sean Noakes was a guard?
No, the family court system is such that juvenile records are sealed. Mm-hmm. I believe after a number of years are even destroyed. But regardless whether they're destroyed or not, they're definitely sealed and there's no access to them. So there was no way to worry about that.
And Michael's intention was to lose this case, this no-lose case, in order to get his childhood friends off.
Yeah, to make them...
For a murder that they did.
Right. which is a murder in the eyes of the law is wrong, in our eyes was not.
What did it take to do that? And I got the feeling just from the way that you wrote about it is that you had to get the neighborhood to go along with this, that it was a rather complicated scheme that you had to set up, a kind of more elaborate scam than a lot of the pranks I guess you did as kids.
Right. Yeah. Well, we were better educated. But no, I think what worked to our advantage, one was it was a small, small case. Two shooters killing an anonymous guy does not get a lot of press. I mean, we were fortunate in a number of respects. One, the case was very, very small. And it got very, very, you know, in a city of over 2,200 murders, you know, nobody's going to pay attention to a shooting like that. A, there were only a small group of people who knew about it. You can't trust 50 people on something like this. You have to limit it. In our case, I think it was limited to 6 or 7 people. Fortunately, with the right, it was the right 6 or 7. Now, the key to the plan was that we each of us only knew the little bit that Michael allowed us to know. He was the only one that really knew A to Z. I knew, say, H to J. Somebody else knew A to B. Somebody else had C to D. So that's what made it. It was all planned out in his own mind. He had the entire alphabet. We each had a couple of letters. So as long as we stayed to that, even if we were caught, worst case scenario, we get captured and the scheme is, at the time, is brought to light. You know, I get a mild slap on the hand. Michael gets disbarred, which he didn't care about anyway. John and Tommy go to jail, which they were expecting to do. But still, we would then say, the obvious question people would bring up is, why have you done this? And then we would have a response to it. So his plan in that sense was sort of foolproof in that he was ready to go to the mat one way or the other. I mean, to me, he is the hero, or one of the two heroes of the book, in the sense that he gave up everything. He gave up the law. He gave up his life. He sacrificed everything for his friends and for the people he cared about. And I don't think there's a truer definition of a hero than that.
Lorenzo Carcaterra's book is called Sleepers. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Fresh Air. Lorenzo Carcaterra will be back with us in the second part of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're back with Lorenzo Carcaterra, author of the new book Sleepers. When Carcaterra was 12, a harmless childhood prank that went horribly wrong landed him and his three best friends in a reformatory in upstate New York. There, they were subjected to daily torment at the hands of four guards who took sadistic delight in physically, sexually, and emotionally abusing them. They survived their year in reform school but went home scarred, embittered, and changed. Two of the boys, Johnny and Tommy, grew to be professional criminals. Michael became a district attorney in New York City, and Carcaterra embarked on a career as a writer. By chance, in 1979, John and Tommy found themselves in the same place as their former abuser. They killed him and were arrested. Michael convinced the DA's office to let him prosecute the case, hiding his connection to the victim and the accused. He lost the case on purpose, getting his friends off. To pull this off, Michael had to get the whole neighborhood to go along with his false case, including the local priest, Father Bobby, a favorite with the kids because, in many ways, he was just like them.
There's a lot about him that's a mystery, you know, because he's very secretive about certain things. I knew from other people that he himself was a juvenile years earlier. He's a tough guy. He was a fighter. He was much tougher than we were. What we loved about him is we pulled scams on every teacher we had. But with him, you had to be very careful because any scam we could even remotely think of, he had done. But you know, when he took us, for example, we used to go on excursions as children to Rye Beach. He knew the scam to do at Rye Beach is you rent a rowboat, you sneak into another school group, somebody, you know, whatever, say St. Barnabas's school or whatever. You then go in their rowboat and you dig a little hole in their rowboat and watch them sink. I mean, so he knew that. And
he'd done it all.
Well, yeah, when we got on the bus, he looked for the guy with the corkscrew.
Well, what did it take to get Father Bobby to lie on the stand, which is what he did?
Right. He doesn't consider it, nor do I consider it a lie. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church has this philosophy, which I buy totally into, is that you punish the sin, not the sinner. And I think he looked at it. We gave him, you know, I laid it out for him. And I left it the way our relationship has been and the way my relationship has been with all my friends who are still remaining, the few that are there for 30 years, is that there's such trust between us that I said to him, if you do this, you don't do this, nothing changes. We still are what we are. But I trusted him to know everything that went on. And I laid it out for him one night in his little apartment. Little room. He lit a cigarette and he said, all right, I got something, you know, I got a decision to make. And he made what he felt was a truthful decision. He does not feel in his mind, yes, you look up the definition of lie, yes, he lied. In the overall scheme of the world, did he do a better good than not? I think he did.
And what he said was that John and Tommy were with him.
At a basketball game. Where else would they be? Father Bobby plays basketball 2 hours a day. We had ticket stubs, which are not hard to come by in that neighborhood at that time. If you're from Hell's Kitchen and the garden was a place, again, even though it had moved to its current location, a number of people from the neighborhood still work there. Again, I don't know the specifics of how he got the stubs, who gave him the stubs or whatever this scheme they came up with. But he took the stand and put John and Tommy at a place other than where they were the night of the shooting, which came as much of a shock to John and Tommy as it did to anybody else.
Which was enough to get them off.
Yeah, there are some attorneys have read the book and have eliminated Father Bobby from the case, and they still think Michael would have lost. It's a lot like the O.J. Simpson. Somebody compared it to the O.J. Simpson trial that of the four witnesses that existed, two backed down, and one testified, and she was shaky. They found she drank a little too much, so you have really had a shaky witness. They couldn't find a murder weapon, and they couldn't find a motive.
Well, let me ask you, does this book in any way incriminate you or others who conspired to get these two men off?
No, I don't think we did anything legally wrong. Personally, all I did was shuffle some papers. I don't even know what was in them. I moved them from step A to step B. And I guess the only person I would imagine, I'm not an attorney, so I know the only person that could, Michael, I guess they could go after, but, he's not practiced. That was his last case or one of his last cases. He never cared to practice anymore. So, you know, if they did find his true identity, which I hope they don't, but if they did find it, I guess, you know, they would disbar him or whatever you do to a lawyer, penalize him. Father Bobby, I think if you know the church found out which clergyman it was, would probably get whatever retribution, but within the confines of the Catholic Church.
But aren't there records of this trial? And I don't mean to be too nitpicky here, but I'm just trying to paper trail might be.
Well, the paper trail was taken care of by Michael. I saw documents by Michael and by a police officer, a high-ranking officer, who helped me piece through the case and help me choose what to disguise, what to move, change of venue, change of scenery, change of dates, how to alter everything but still stay to the truth of the story. Then the documents were given back, and what was done with them, I don't know.
John Riley and Tommy Marcano got off for this crime, but they ended up dead. What happened to them?
Well, what happened to them was something that we talked about. We did talk about that, you know, they chose a certain life for themselves. And they knew it was a life that would end with a bullet. But it's better than a life of that they had known it at the institution. Nobody was going to come after them. They knew it was a short life. It would end very violently, but it would end on their own terms. And quite honestly, I really believe that they're the fortunate ones in my story, that they are indeed dead.
More fortunate than you?
Yeah, more fortunate than me, more fortunate than Michael, certainly. Because it ends for them. The moment they died, it ended. For Michael and myself, in various degrees, it will never end. This book will come and go, and you know you'll read it, not read it. You'll like it, not like it. The memories will stay with me forever until the day I die. The physical problems we have, are worse than scars. Quite honestly, are very nightmarish, and the nighttime still bothers me. I feel very uncomfortable in among people and in groups. Michael feels so much so that he's isolated his entire life for years, and has lived in foreign lands because the whole experience not only made him distrustful of the system, of other people, made him really distrustful of his very own place where he grew up and lived, his own country.
You mentioned the fact that you have physical problems related to what happened to you. What kinds of physical problems are you talking about?
Well, I have severe back pains and leg pains that are just, you know, you go to about 40 different doctors and there's nothing you can do about it. I have an inner ear imbalance that I'm trying currently under physical therapy to straighten out, that it's hard for me to stay steady for a long period of time. And again, the therapists have all said that's related to my childhood beatings. Physically, there's, on paper, I'm healthy. But you look at the, except for the inner ear, there's definitely damage done to the inner ear. There's damage to the back. There's damage to the neck area. So other than that, I'm healthy. Mentally, it's made it, you know, all those problems are, those physical problems are fed by the mental thoughts that go through your mind. So a pinch in the arm to you, maybe just, you know, a mild irritation. To me, it's like, you know, a baton swing.
My guest is Lorenzo Carcaterra, author of Sleepers. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Lorenzo Carcaterra, author of Sleepers, a story of four friends growing up in Hell's Kitchen and the brutal year they spent in a reformatory that changed their lives. At the end of the story, you have kind of encapsulated what happened to the kind of cast of characters. How hard was it for you to track down what happened to some of these guards or some of the other players in this particular story?
Again, it was only as hard as reaching out. I mean, I'm fortunate that I come from an area and I spent most of my life with cops or criminals. And if you spend your life with cops or criminals, that you covered everything. You covered A and B. And so if you can't find it from a criminal, you'll find it from a cop. If you can't find it from a cop, you find it from a criminal. I'm not a great reporter by any means. I just had friends and people who would, in cop terminology, reach out and get me information and were kind enough to give it to me. And then all I had to simply do was alter dates, change names, change places and all that stuff. But I had the basic stuff. You know, somebody would call and say, so-and-so died this way, for example. And I'd say, okay, I knew then how he really died. And then I just would make him dead, but make him dead in a different place, in a different time, and a different locale.
Your first book, A Safe Place, was about your father and your relationship with him and the fact that he murdered his first wife. Your second book, Sleepers, is also about your family, your childhood.
Right.
Are you going to write more about your family?
No, this is it. We're going to bury Lorenzo now.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think next one will be, next one's going to be fun, I hope. But it's definitely not me. I think, I mean, what more could happen? I mean, you know, it's a pretty packed 20-something years. No, I wrote a first book about my father, and I dealt with that. And I wrote a second book about my friends, and I dealt with that. And now I think it's time to, you know, write about something else.
It seems in certain ways that your family helped you through this difficult chapter in your life. Mm-hmm. And yet there's another whole story, another whole side of the family that you came from, the fact that your father killed his first wife. Mm-hmm. How do you see those two stories of your family connected?
That the violence and the help at the same time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's typical of I mean, I talked to, for the first book, I talked to a lot of people who either were children of a parent who had killed somebody or were on the receiving end and had a parent murdered. And I think, again, they're all from the same lower working class environment. And, you know, they're there for you. I mean, to give you a terrific example, I think, my father's family obviously was quite upset with me for the first book. And, you know, from their end, rightfully so. You're writing about something that's 40, 50 years old, and why bring it up? Who cares about it other than the family? That's the mentality. Nobody outside the family should know. Yet at the same time, with this book, they're very defensive of me. So it's that old mentality, hey, you can call Lorenzo a bum. I can call him a bum because he's my Lorenzo. You don't know him, so stay out of it. So I think my father came to, you know, we had a really rough and tumble. The first 14 years of my life, he was one of my best friends along with the three guys from the streets. And then, you know, I found out what had happened, and it sort of soured the relationship for a number of years until he was dying, and then we reunited again. So the first book was about that, was about my relationship with my father, which was as complicated, I guess, as any father-son relationship gets.
Well, as you say, he was one of your best friends, and yet he was responsible for 35 stitches on your body.
Yeah, well, that's not uncommon in poor neighborhoods. I mean, he was a man of the moment. He was a man of action. He was... you know, he responded violently because it was the only way he knew how to respond to situations. And it was done, you know, some of it was done because I was blocking my mother and, you know, preventing her from getting hurt. Others were done simply because, you know, I mean, especially the the Wilkinson period, I mean, frightened him that I could run with a bad crowd. And that was, he had always said to me, he said, I'm going to give you a choice. But if I'm given the choice of a drug-addicted son or a dead son, I will take the dead son. And, you know, and I believed him. To this day, I mean, I was always convinced, you know, when you're in your 20s and you go to these parties and there's cocaine out and there's all that stuff, and, you know, like anybody else, you're really tempted to try it. I was convinced the minute I went near it, like some closet door would open and he'd come flying out and beating the hell out of me. So it kept me, I mean, you know, I mean, I never even tried the mildest form of drug. I mean, other than the drugs they give me to numb the back pain. But I think he in his own way, he was a great father. And I, you know, as, despite the beatings, despite the abuse, I regret now, quite honestly, that he's, when I wrote that first book, I grew to really miss him. It brought closure to him with me. And he was a buddy. You know, he was, you know, it's tough for people to understand who are not from that kind of violent world. But, you know, he would have never, he would always, always have been there for me, regardless of the circumstance, regardless of the situation. I mean, if he were alive today, I would defy anybody who questioned the validity of my book. He'd be in their face in about 5 seconds, physically in their face, which is, you know, not a pleasant sight.
Well, you were incarcerated just before your 13th birthday, left out, got out 1 year later, and it was at the age of 14 that you found out what your father had done with his first wife, and you found out from your mother.
Yeah, it was a tough couple of years, to put it mildly, but, you know, everybody has hardships in their life. I'm sure there are things in your life that have been very difficult for you to get through, and somehow you wade through them. You don't like to do it. You don't like to have to go through it, you know. I'm always amazed, you know, friends of mine who, you know, have been in therapy for 25, 30 years for the most minuscule things, you know, like their father never talked to them, you know, or didn't talk to them enough at dinner. I never had that. My father, he was always there. And, you know, I just had to deal with the fact that he killed somebody. And I had to deal with it from the point of view, A, how he could have done it, how he could live with it. And was I capable of doing the same thing? That was one of the things that tormented. I mean, I have a lot of torments in my mind. I'm obviously a troubled person, I guess. But that goes through your mind, as well as what happened to you while you were away for the year and what happened to you with your friends. So I think I put about 100 years of life in the first 20 or something years of my own life. So this boring phase that I'm in is kind of refreshing. It puts people asleep when they hear what I do during the day. But for me, it's, you know, it gives me time to sort things out. And it may take, you know, it doesn't take just two books to sort it out. It takes a lifetime to sort out these emotional conflicts I've faced. I don't think I'll ever come to terms with my own past as what's described in Sleepers.
Well, Lorenzo Carcaterra, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and talking about your latest book.
Thank you.
Lorenzo Carcaterra's book is called Sleepers. This is Fresh Air.